Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here. My name's Dylan Thompson. I'm with Deep Green Resistance. I want to thank Kai and Direct Action Spokane for having me, and I just want to say it's an honor to be sharing a panel with these three courageous and brave human beings. This event tonight is about direct action, but I think it's even more largely about just that, bravery and courage. And I don't know about you, but I see kind of that we're at a turning point. In the Northwest especially, there's just been increasing mobilization around pipelines, coal trains, oil trains, coal export terminals. And that's only a good thing. And we need to keep it rolling, as Mike was saying. So I want to talk a little bit about how we have been spinning our wheels a lot. You know, the action that needs to be taken probably should have been taken a while ago. But I want to start out with a little story about the British abolitionists, actually. The late 1800s, when the slave trade was at its peak, a group of abolitionist activists confronted somebody named William Wilberforce, and used him in Parliament to fight the slave trade. It took him 20 years to lobby Parliament and get Parliament to pass the Slave Trade Act, which eventually shut down the British slave trade. And the abolitionist activists were organizing in Britain, going around, gaining support in Parliament. But still, their main avenue, their main interface of that battle was in Parliament. And why did it take them 20 years? They had this moral argument. They brought in the chains that Africans were made to wear on the march to the ships to be sent to the West Indies. They had schematics of the ships that these people were crammed into. Why did it take 20 years for that moral argument to win out? And it's because it was going up against the economic argument, exactly. And it was going up against a system that supported the British Empire. People in Parliament had hands in that very slave trade. So to me, that is an example of an argument that to us just seems so reasonable and moral, not winning out because of a system that immorality supports. And so now to fast forward to the modern day. Most people think of the modern environmental movement as beginning largely with the 1960s, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, being published in 1962. That's what people tend to call the start of the contemporary environmental movement. So that means we've had over 50 years, over half a century of a modern environmental movement. And yet every living system is in decline, as Mike was saying. Everything's getting worse. And direct action, which is the topic of tonight's presentation, is important when you are a community wanting to protect yourself and protect your community from things like harmful coal trains going through your town. But it's also, I think, extremely important that we recognize that direct action is necessary from beginning to end. So environmentalists like to talk about what happens at the end of the production system. We like to talk about the carbon in the atmosphere, the toxins in the rivers, the outputs, the global warming. But we also got to remember that the current supply chain, the current industrial supply chain, enslaves more human beings than at any time in human history. We have more need now for an abolitionist movement than any time in the human history. Kevin Bales, has anybody heard of Kevin Bales? He does a lot of anti-slavery work, and he has traveled everywhere and determined that there are at least 27 million slaves currently in the world today, at least. And that number only accounts for those who are held in slavery at the point of a gun, basically, forced into slavery. That does not account for those who are forced into slavery through economic conditions. Did anybody see that Associated Press article that came out just a little while ago? A lot of the seafood on the shelves in stores, a lot of it gets mixed up with stuff that has, slavery in East Asia. So my point with this is, why has it taken us so long? We've had 50 plus years of a modern environmental movement, and every living system is in decline. Why? Well, that's why I brought up the abolitionists of Britain. They tried to take this argument that was very moral into the halls of Parliament and make it against the people who made the rules and who built the slave trade. In essence, we're doing the same thing, and we've been doing the same thing for the past 50 years plus. We take our moral argument that says we don't want to destroy the planet for future generations, not only of humans, but the countless other non-humans who are our kin. We're not going to destroy the planet, which seems utterly reasonable to us, but we go in time after time after time after time and get shut down, or we get thrown a bone. And my story is, you know, what brought me into consciousness, I am involved with a nonprofit, a Bellingham-based nonprofit called Fertile Ground Environmental Institute, and I'm pleased and at this unexpected surprise that two of the founders just showed up, and I was not expecting that. But you'll remember this story. In 2010, I believe it was, we realized that tar sands crude was coming into Bellingham from Alberta. And we're like, okay, we need to hold some educational events, let the community know what's happening in our town, and lobby the city council. We had a friend in the city council who was very opposed to the tar sands and was willing to front some ordinances that we wanted to get passed. But what we learned in this process was that the city council's hands were tied beyond creating just symbolic ordinances that say we don't like the tar sands, we don't like that it comes in to our community, because it's an issue of commerce. So we've been taking our moral argument into institutions that operate, that follow a system of law that serves commerce and corporate business before it serves communities. And that's the basis of it. We got that model, and Kai and Direct Action Spokane have a much more nuanced version of this, but it's British common law. It's ironic that the American Revolution happened and they were trying to get away from British law, but the Constitution is adopted from old British common law, which serves property first and foremost. So that's the point. That's the biggest point I wanted to make tonight, was that we need to stop kidding ourselves. And I think, you know, honestly, Mike, I admire people like Mike, because I don't have as much faith in governmental politics, you know, at this point, but we still need people like you running and trying to change things from within. We need it from all sides. But what I want to say is we need direct action now, because we've been trying to make this moral argument in our own halls of parliament for far too long. Another thing I wanted to say was that this whole experience in Bellingham and beyond made me want to learn about other social movements. What have people done in the past, and what are people doing now when faced with a desperate situation? Nobody's facing really anything as desperate as climate change and planetary annihilation, but there have been some desperate things in the past. And so what I found was that the environmental movement, what we've been calling the environmental movement, really isn't a movement, because movements generally put pressure on those in power until those in power concede and the changes are made. The missing element there is pressure. So, you know, take any big social movement of the past, apartheid South Africa. You had the African National Congress, who began above ground and nonviolent and lobbied for the rights of black Africans in South Africa. And when the African National Congress was declared illegal by the apartheid government, that's when Nelson Mandela started the Umkhonto Oasis Way and started a campaign of sabotage. I think a lot of people know that Nelson Mandela was a hero in the destruction of the apartheid regime, but he was a militant underground organizer of sabotage. And that was the pressure that it took the apartheid government to come to the table, to come to the negotiation table. And, you know, in progressive circles, I've heard so much good things said about the civil rights movement and the Indian resistance to British imperialism, led by Gandhi especially. And I just like to point out that Martin Luther King himself, I think, recognized the usefulness of people like Malcolm X and groups like the Deacons for Defense. They were the very, very militant side of the civil rights movement, because what that did was it made the white establishment want to listen to Martin Luther King Jr. and the nonviolent activists. They were all of a sudden the nice people. They were the nice face in those struggles. The same with Gandhi. Does anybody know who Bhagat Singh was? Has anybody heard that name? At the same time Gandhi was doing his thing, Bhagat Singh was bombing British halls of government in India, the colonial establishment in India, making Gandhi and what he was doing seem to be the nicer face of things. So it should be clear that we don't really have that as far as the environmental movement goes. You know, we've had radical environmentalism. I live in Eugene, Oregon, the birthplace of the Earth Liberation Front. But mainstream environmentalists distance ourselves from that kind of action. We call it names. We call it too radical. They were too rash. I agree on the strategical points. I don't think those were strategic groups, but we need to stop being scared of breaking the law. And I'm not saying that, you know, that's what the main thing that's holding us up. I think there is a lot of fear around that, but the precedent has been set over and over again in history of people breaking the law for a higher moral purpose. And if these gentlemen haven't, you know, already made the point that now is the time, the higher purpose is here. I don't know what else, you know, needs to happen. But so these trains that are coming through communities in the Northwest are a perfect opportunity for us to really build a culture of resistance. So I think maybe also I want to say that maybe some of you are thinking, well, what do I do? Do I either get on a track? Do I either put my body on the line or do nothing? Culture of resistance, I think, is a phrase that we need to be thinking about. Because another struggle that I've looked at is the struggle of the Irish. The Irish Republican Army challenging British colonialism. They were a very militant group, but only 2% of the IRA ever picked up arms. The other 98% were doing support work. They were the network of safe houses. They were the food suppliers. They were the legal help. They were the insiders in government. We need those people now, because if people are going to put their bodies on the line, then they need a culture of support to make them feel comfortable enough to do that. And right now, I don't see a lot of that happening. But like I said, I think we're at a turning point, and I see more of it happening in the Northwest, and I see more people supporting it. Conferences I go to about environmentalism, you know, will say people from Deep Green Resistance and other organizations will be saying things like this. And where we used to get critical feedback, people who were not liking what we were saying, I'm not seeing that as much anymore. I'm seeing a more general acceptance of the need for more serious action. So, you know, that's really all I wanted to say tonight. Again, I want these gentlemen's actions to be the example that leads all of us forward in building that culture of resistance, and maybe even perhaps putting ourselves on the line for this work. So thank you very much.